Welcome to the This Is Money show in partnership with NS&I, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lamb and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside Simon Nye is consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And we're back to our favourite game of Will He, Won't He. Mark Carney, that unreliable boyfriend, is back and dropping some heavy hints that interest rates could be on the rise before Christmas. But haven't we heard all this before from the Governor of the Bank of England? And would it be a wise move?
It would be a very brave thing for a central banker to do, to increase interest rates at a time when the housing market looks like it might be rolling over.
Well, regardless of exactly when rates will go up, experts say this really is the last call to fix your mortgage. If you want to get a super low rate, we'll tell you how. We ask, is Britain turning into a home buyer's paradise, with asking prices falling by more than 3,000 in a month? But where is struggling the most? Also coming up, just weeks after it appeared expat pensions would be safe post-Brexit, we're now being warned they may not be. Plus, another successful investigation by This Is Money, but which company has hauled over the coals this time, how you can get your energy bills paid off for a decade, and is Lee a tenor millionaire? All that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.
But first, Simon, it looks like you may actually be right. I'm not suggesting you aren't always right, of course, but you did say you thought rates could rise by the end of the year, and that was just before Mark Carney himself came out and dropped a very big hint that we could see them go up in November. I know, don't hold your breath, we've been down this road before. But David Coombs from Rathbones thinks the Bank of England has run out of ideas and any rise would be dangerous.
The Bank of England has to wait to see what the autumn statement brings from the government. What are the government's fiscal policy plans? Because monetary policy has to dovetail with that. If Philip Hammond raises taxes, interest rate rises seem totally unnecessary. And also, given we don't know what the outcome of the Brexit negotiations are, I think interest rates should be left alone because there's just not enough information upon which to make a decision. Sterling has already risen quite significantly against the dollar, for example, over the last week or so. And maybe that's all that the Bank of England wanted to happen, because that is one of the key tools at the moment to subdue inflation, is to bolster sterling. I've gotten a stage where, frankly, I'm starting to ignore what Mr. Carney and the Bank of England says, because frankly, their track record on sending signals to the market or to investors has been, frankly, fairly woeful. I think, and the way I'm positioned at the moment in the funds that I run is, well, I think the risk of a recession in the UK is higher than it's been for some significant time, probably the last 10 years since the global financial crisis, which is why I get so frustrated by this talk of rising interest rates. With Brexit negotiations kind of floundering, that's not exactly creating the right environment to encourage capital investment in our economy, whether it's domestic or, and even worse, overseas. So the economy is in a pretty fragile state right now. And I think it needs all the help it can get in the short term. And having a Bank of England prevaricating when there is so much uncertainty is less than helpful, which is probably a huge understatement.
David Coombs, manager of Rathbone Multi-Asset Portfolio Funds there. So, Simon, a rise would be dangerous. We're only talking a smidge here, though, right?
Yes, we are talking about potentially going back up to the heady heights of the 0.5% that the base rate was cut to after the financial crisis and then stayed at for a considerably long length of time until we decided to vote ourselves out of the EU. And the Bank of England decided that another emergency rate cut was needed. And what normally happens is you have a cycle. So the idea would be that we're going to raise interest rates, and then we're going to raise them again, and then we're going to raise them again, and then we're going to get to the top of that cycle, and then that something's going to happen, recession's going to come, and then we're going to cut interest rates again. Now, the thought is that the more gentle the rise, the easier it will be for households and businesses and so on. Whereas if the Bank of England starts making noises about a steeper rise, then those households and those businesses are going to go, ooh, we need to set a bit more money aside because stuff's going to get a bit more expensive. You know, the cost of servicing our debts is going to go up. And let's remember that we have a lot of debts. Household finances aren't in the greatest of shapes. But really, I don't think interest rates are going to go particularly high in this cycle. we've already had that from the Bank of England repeatedly, that they don't think they're going to go much above 2% in this cycle. I don't necessarily think a rise would be dangerous now. I think we would be more than capable of taking it within our stride. I think what David is referring to there is more of the sort of the message that it sends out, and the worry that people will think, oh, well, if they're raising it now, before the end of the year, in November, this soon, oh, they're going to keep going higher. Who knows? I think that basically what will happen, and this was why my prediction of we might see one this year, there's enough people on the MPC who are keen to maybe be seen to be start to moving rates up. I think that we will see a rate rise. I think that we will then see rates stick at 0.5% for a considerable period of time. I don't think that that upward cycle will continue. I think this may be one of those rare scenarios where you see one rise and then we stick.
But many economists, though, aren't they saying in the next couple of years it could go up to 2.25%? And in terms of sort of materially the pound in our pocket, because that's kind of what people are thinking about. How literally, physically, is this going to impact on me? Just taking a look at some of the figures. If the base rate went up to 0.5%, the average homeowner with a £150,000 variable mortgage would see their repayments go up by about £259. If it went up 0.75%, you're looking at £520. But that 2.25%, you're looking at over £1,000 a year that people will have to find. And bearing in mind, there's a whole generation of people who've never known an interest rate rise. And your sister paper, Money Mail, has got an article here, Lee, about how concerned should we be by this big debt mountain that you just referred to there, Simon, that we seem to have built for ourselves. And they're warning home buyers, young home buyers particularly, are walking into a debt time bomb with interest rate rise could send mortgage bills spiralling. How concerned should we be by this big debt pile that we've built for ourselves?
I think we should be extremely worried by it, Georgie, because if you think about it and how quickly house prices have gone up in certain pockets of the country, you know, in the last couple of years, a lot of people are stretching themselves in order to buy a property. And what that means is a lot of people are putting down a 5 or a 10% deposit. It means a massive loan to get the property, and they might be borrowing way beyond their means to do this. Now, banks have, in their defence, tried to crack down on a lot of this since before the financial crisis, because that's how a lot of people got in trouble in the first place. So there have been sort of rules put in place to make sure that people don't borrow too much. But even still, if you're looking at, let's say a first-time buyer in London, for example, and you're dropping £500,000 on a property and you're finding 10% of that, you know, £50,000, in £450,000 you're borrowing, okay, rates at the moment are at record lows on mortgages. So, you know, a couple of percent, maybe 3%. If they start nudging up, that's a really big dent into your pocket. And it's not just a London problem. It is, you know, across the country, people are doing this. So people have got to be worried about this. And what our sister Tita was saying in the story is basically those who have put down 5 or 10% and then borrow at least 3.5 times their salary or 2¾ times their salary for couples are in this kind of, you know, worrying patch where if interest rates do go up, you could be struggling. But quite a lot of people have fixed their mortgages, so you might have a clutch of people on 2-year fixes. Some people fix them for 5 years because rates are so low. And if you've had a good broker or you've done a lot of research, people might be getting pushed into these sort of more fixed terms because it gives you more stability, and you kind of know mortgage rates really can't go any lower. It'd be almost impossible. So it's a worry on one hand, and on the other hand, hopefully the age of reckless lending isn't quite as what it once was.
Yeah, absolutely. And fixed rates is exactly where I want to go right now, because experts are suggesting, and again, I know we've heard this one or two times before, that whatever the date of a rate rise, be it November or a little bit later on, you may want to look at fixing your mortgage now. Since financial crisis, we've heard this over and over again, haven't we, though? And each time it's proved to be a false alarm. These rates have got a record super lower, but actually we're seeing a load of them out there at the moment. Yep. And you're saying the warnings are these are going to last mere weeks.
Well, this is it. So over the last couple of weeks, there's been a clutch of massive lenders who have slashed their fixed rate mortgages. And actually, what the thought process behind that, what seems to be the case, is that it's coming to the end of the financial year for quite a lot of these lenders. So they're pushing these rates out to get more mortgage borrowers onto their books. So it means that the market's got really competitive. I mean, there's a number of mortgages that have come out under 1%. For example, Yorkshire Building Society, 0.99% for 2 years, but that's just on a 80% LTV, which is, you know, kind of unheard of to be able to borrow cash for that kind of level. All right, the product fee is almost £1,500, so you've always got to sort of crunch the figures and make sure that's correct. But Daniel Bailey, who's a broker at Middleton Finance, says there's arguably never been a better time to get a longer fix. I keep telling my clients that mortgage rates will never again be as low in our lifetime, so now is the time to take advantage of them. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there's quite a few brokers saying that up and down the country at the moment.
Wow. Simon, how long should you fix for? How much can you save? What are the tips that you should be doing to get the best deals?
It depends how long you're going to live in your property for. So if you fix for a long time, you should be able to take that mortgage with you if it's what's known as portable. But it will have to be, when you move, your new property will have to be reassessed and you might need to borrow more money. However, there is a phenomenon where people always underestimate how long they're going to live in a property for. They say 2 or 3 years. Normally, it's at least 5. It's amazing how quickly 5 years passes. I've been living in my flat for 5 years. There's a load of stuff that we meant to do when we moved in. We still haven't done it yet. 5 years down the line. This is a phenomenon that goes right across the board. So the 5-year fix is definitely something to be considering. What it means is you lock into lower payments. It means that you're not going to be paying as cheap a rate as a 2-year fix, but also you're not going to have to worry about it in 2 years. And if you think 5 years rolls around quickly, you should see how quickly 2 years rolls around. But then 2 years' time, you're going to have to pay more fees to remortgage again. So actually, the comparison of those two things, when you compare the 5-year, where you pay one fee at the start, one fee in 5 years' time, versus a 2-year, where you pay a fee now, a fee in 2 years, a fee in 4 years, all of a sudden, the costs converge quite a lot. And also, I think if we are worrying about interest rates going up, if we are worrying about interest rates hitting the heady heights of potentially 2%, Bank of England goes, woohoo, crazy, we're going to go all the way to 2%, like a rocket ship. We're going to reach that 2% probably in about 2 years' time, at which point you might find that the housing market is turning, a recession is here, and all of a sudden banks and building societies are a lot less keen to lend. And what caught people out last time round was this belief that you would always be able to remortgage at about roughly the same rate that you took your mortgage out. And all of a sudden, the financial crisis happened. Banks and building societies freaked out, decided that they weren't lending. House prices started falling. And people discovered that they could not remortgage at about the same rate that they took their mortgage out. And that, in fact, if they were going to remortgage, it would be at a considerably more expensive rate, or they were going to move on to their standard variable rate. And that's what you want to watch out for with that 2-year fix. You can go for 3. You can even do, there's some unusual 4s out there, or there's a 5. But don't just listen to a broker who says to you to do 2 years because it's cheaper. You need to be asking them the question of, why are you recommending 2 to me instead of 5? Because actually, and if you're the kind of person who's happy to play the interest rate guessing game, who reads all the time about interest rates, thinks all the time about it and thinks, okay, I can play the market. I reckon they're not going to go up by that much. I think, like Simon, they're going to go up once and then they're going to stick there. Then play that game. And if you've got plenty of equity and you've got plenty of leeway, then play that game by all means. But if you're the kind of person who isn't interested in interest rates, isn't interested in any of this stuff, finds the whole finding a mortgage, remortgaging, doing all these things to just be a costly, time-consuming and painful process, then maybe you might want to think about a 5-year fix, just because it gives you an easier life and you don't have to worry about this stuff for another 5 years. We should bear in mind here that I should point out that you are talking to a man with a tracker rate mortgage. I'll say all this stuff about fixed rates, okay? But this is an example of someone who's willing to play the game, okay? I have a tracker rate mortgage, and when we bought our flat, I took out, and this is how wrong you can be, okay? Mm-hmm. We took out, Nationwide had this great deal. It wasn't a lifetime tracker, it was a 5-year tracker. But it was cheap. They paid all your legal work and for a survey, even if you were moving home. Now, normally people only do that if you're remortgaging. You could get out of it with no early repayment charges. So I thought, this looks like a good deal. But I fully expected that about 3 years into that, I was probably going to have to jump ship, take out a new mortgage, probably go for a fix because interest rates were going to be rising. I actually did remortgage because I wanted to get an offset mortgage, again, to a lifetime tracker mortgage this time round with First Direct. There was a minimal fee. I can get out of it anytime I want. I like the offset facility where you can balance your savings against your mortgage and you only pay interest on the gap in the middle. Again, I expected to be having to jump out of that by now because interest rates were going to be on the rise. And I'm still sitting there on that mortgage.
Still
going
to sit there?
And unbelievably, you know, last August, after the Brexit vote, my payments went down. I never expected my payments to go down. So you're talking to someone who writes the What Next for Interest Rates Roundup, who's been writing about mortgages in the property market for well over a decade. And I was repeatedly wrong on this. So if you don't have the sort of willingness to go, right, I am effectively taking a bit of a gamble here, and the ability to pay for that gamble if it goes wrong against you, then fixed rates are probably the best thing.
At least you're smiling about being wrong though, Simon. It could be worse. Okay, so should you pay a mortgage broker? Advisors are accused of double dipping by charging fees when they already get paid by lenders. What's this about, Lee?
So basically, if you use a mortgage broker and they give you advice about, you know, which product you should get, you've always got to bear in mind that they may prefer a certain product over another product because they're going to get more commission out of it. And that's always something to really consider. So what this research is saying is that a lot of people don't realise that a broker gets commission from a lender for sorting out the mortgage, but you're also paying them. So they're getting two lots of payment for effectively getting you a mortgage. So, you know, someone's got a bit annoyed about this because I think people actually, especially, let's talk about first-time buyers again. I think a lot of first-time buyers would just think that's what you've got to do. You've got to pay a broker. That's what you need to do. And you just hand over these fees and then it's done. But it's not necessarily the case. There's lots of out there that, you know, don't charge. For example, our partner at This Is Money, London & Country, don't they? You know, one of the biggest brokers in the country.
Why do they not? Why do some do, some don't?
Because I think what it is, if you're more of a small-scale broker, you're probably more likely to charge to get that extra money because you're a smaller player in the market. Whereas if you're a bigger player, you've probably got more products available. And what London & Country say, for example, is that they rely sheerly on the commission that they get for lenders, and that's why they can give free advice to people, you know, for mortgage advice. So it's definitely something worth considering. You should definitely find out how much a broker is going to charge you. It's definitely worth finding out how much commission you got. I used a mortgage broker and he was very upfront. He said, you know, I will get commission for who I recommend, and I charge you a very small fee. It was about 50 quid or something. It wasn't a lot of money. It was just kind of, you know, like almost just a payment, so I wasn't wasting his time, because I might have just pulled out and said, actually, I don't want any of this. So I kind of see it from all viewpoints, but as I say, it's just something worth considering.
All right, I just want to ask before we move on from property, are we in home buyer's paradise? We've been talking there about super low mortgage rates, haven't we? Now we're hearing asking prices falling by more than 3,000 in a month. Where is struggling most? Well, it's London. So to use your expression, are home buyers in clover? Is that, have I got that right? No?
No, they're not.
They're
definitely not. No, they're not. I mean, asking prices have been coming down, especially in London particularly. The Rightmove survey measures the asking prices of newly listed properties that month. So instead of bouncing in September, they've actually come down. What you're also seeing across large swathes of London and the South East is not only are the asking prices of those newly listed properties coming down, but then about 3 or 4 weeks later, the asking price of that property comes down further and you get your Rightmove alert that comes around and it has a little reduced on the property. Now, one of my barometers of the property market is the Rightmove alert that I still get sent from when we moved all those years ago, that rounds up properties, similar properties in our area. And I must admit, I have seen a lot more reduceds over the last 6 months to a year. There was a point where you didn't see any reduceds. If you are thinking of moving home, basically, get yourself a Rightmove email alert set up for the area that you're looking at. Make it nice and broad so it doesn't just cover specifically the property you want. Covers a bit of a band, you know, maybe a bedroom less, bedroom more, you know, 100 grand less, 100 grand more. And then keep an eye on it and see whether those reduces are coming out. Because if you're getting lots of emails with the word reduced on it, you can negotiate hard on that property. And so then maybe you are going to stand yourself in good stead. I don't know whether you'd be in paradise, though, no. Really. That's why we had a question mark after the word paradise. So,
in my defence, I didn't say that.
We said that.
Right, yeah. Give us the bigger picture, though, Lee. What is the housing market doing at the moment?
It's kind of trundling along. If you look at indexes that actually are based on sales rather than asking prices. So, for example, the ONS data that came out a couple of weeks ago saying that annually, I always think it's worth looking at it annually because on a monthly basis, you do have little quirks. Annually, prices are up 5%. you know, that's pretty steady growth. I mean, more than that, you're looking at a real sort of like surge in prices, which is what we've seen in the last couple of years. You know, 5%, between about 3 and 5%, it's just kind of steady growth. Again, it is different around the whole country. On an annual basis, every region has seen price increases. But there's still, we had a story on this last week about a number of locations that still haven't had property prices go beyond before the recession hit. So there are still pockets of the country out there that are house price wise aren't doing that great. The whole reason why London's on the slowdown a little bit, and what we were told by an estate agent in that Rightmove article this week, a lot of buyers in London were cash buyers, especially sort of foreign investors, and that has collapsed a little bit, and that has a ripple effect outwards of London. And what it is that a lot of investors think that having a property in London is a sort of safe financial environment. But of course, we've now got 3% stamp duty surcharge on buy to let. And also Brexit, you know, don't underestimate what Brexit's done and the concerns over, you know, how that's going to affect moving money across Europe and all that sort of stuff. It's all had a knock-on impact on London. And actually, if there is going to be a bit of a recession in the next couple of years, you'll start to notice it with those sort of new builds that are popping up everywhere in London. Those apartment blocks that are like rabbit hutches that are literally just like firing up everywhere. If they start not getting sold, that's when you really start seeing those big red herring buildings. You think, ooh, not sure what's going on here. Keep your eye out, Georgie, if you start seeing those get reduced.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.
Always keep my eye out, Lee. Don't worry about it. Now, there's a warning that elderly expats living in EU countries could see their pension payments stopped if there's no Brexit deal after March 2019. Now, this comes just weeks after it looked like pensions were safe for expats. The industry is calling for this issue to be addressed in the ongoing talks, so you're going to have to explain this in a bit more detail if you don't mind, Simon. What's the issue here?
OK, the problem is that MP Nicky Morgan, well-known MP, has come out and issued this warning. And she said that what we talked about previously was to do with rises in the state pension for British expats and whether that would continue. Because there are some countries in the world where you don't get an annual rise in your state pension if you live there. And the list is really weird. And this is, there's been a campaign on this for ages. But the problem here has basically to do also with private pensions, and that pension firms could face a choice between breaking their promises to people and businesses or breaking the law, according to the Association of British Insurers. So Nicky Morgan sent a letter to Chancellor Philip Hammond, said, "The possibility that UK providers may not be legally able to pay out pensions or insurance contracts to citizens in the UK, including UK expats, is a stark example of the consequences of a cliff-edge Brexit. Both the UK and the EU have a strong mutual interest in resolving this problem, in line with their shared objective of a smooth and orderly Brexit." So the problem revolves around millions of insurance and pension contracts written before Brexit that would still be enforced after the UK leaves the EU. Unless negotiations over how to handle such deals are made part of the first phase of Brexit talks, there may not be enough time to resolve the issue effectively. So this is talking about us leaving the EU with no deal, or with a very hastily thrashed out deal that hasn't covered all of these things. And what we might find is that actually the payments that are trying to be made by these private pension providers to people living overseas are breaking the law in some way.
I'm wondering, we're getting quite a few stories like this, and I'm not saying this is not a very real issue, but some might argue that it sounds a little bit like Project Fear back again. A lot of scaremongering by those who want a soft Brexit, that expat pensioners could be left. Well, a lot of people could be left, presumably, in a difficult situation.
Well, it's a bit weird. I mean, it's saying...
If only we had a photo of that. Your face just then, that was brilliant, Simon. What on earth are your thoughts? Go on, tell me.
Well, the suggestion is that the companies might not be able to make the payouts that they know they're meant to make to the people who know they're meant to get them, because the law wouldn't be in place that would mean they would be able to make these payouts. Mm. So what are we going to do? Do we think that the UK is going to go after the companies for making the payments they're meant to be making to the people who are meant to be getting them? Or that the EU is going to go after the companies for making the payments to the people who are meant to be getting them? We're opening a Pandora's box here of weird stuff that could be going on. I find it unbelievable that actually we would go after people for doing this when they know they're meant to be doing it and meant to be paying it to these people.
Plenty of time to discuss those before now in March 2019 and beyond, and I'm sure we will again. But another day, another successful intervention by This Is Money on behalf of Dear Readers. This time, Step Up FTSE 100 giant Reckitt Benckiser. Now, the company has been forced to return thousands of pounds of pension contributions. Now, this is after you guys got involved, you investigated a third dispute involving missed or delayed post with ex-staff. Now, this is all about a young lady, Dr. Leah Gray, who was initially refused around £8,700 of company contributions on the grounds that she hadn't acted on a letter giving a three-month deadline to move her pension after she left her job in 2011. Now, I'm guessing, Lee, she didn't get said letters?
This is absolutely sneaky practices from a giant firm like this. It's actually really quite diabolical what they've done in this case and the other cases that we've covered. So basically, in a nutshell, our reader, who is the third person to get in touch with this same problem, worked for the firm for fewer than 2 years. So that seems to be where the problem comes about. Now, she'd sorted out her pension when she first sort of got in there, was making contributions herself, and then the company was either matching it or offering extra. And it seems to have been a very generous pension scheme. Now, she left, hadn't really, I guess, given much thought about the pensions situation, but the firm said that they sent out a letter saying there was a three-month deadline to move her pension, you know, after she left. And we're just talking about the contributions that the company made. Mm-hmm. So not hers, just what they've made. And then, lo and behold, she didn't get back in touch with them because she didn't receive the letter. You know, it's very difficult to send letters. People move around and all that sort of stuff. And she sort of been battling the firm for a long time, asking where this money had gone. They'd just taken the money back. It was in the rules of their contract that they just take the money, just goes back to the company.
If you don't give them,
I'm so outraged. This really, you know, she was in her early 20s. She had the foresight to sort out her pension and, you know, make contributions into it and get paid handsomely from the company. And a lot of time you do kind of like leave a job and you don't think straight away about what that pension pot and what you're going to do with it, because she's in her mid-20s. I mean, she's not going to retire for another 40, 50 years. So it's like, you know, it's very difficult to keep on top of all that. I doubt she would have known that in 3 months that would have just been gone back to the company. They're the only firm that seemed to
I've discussed this with you quite a few times, you know, about the multiple pension pots we seem to have. And, you know, you would automatically think, oh, it's fine there until I do something with
it. Exactly. But, I mean, almost £9,000 is a substantial...
That is not a small amount of money,
It's a substantial amount of money for them just to sort of, like, claw back and then to not sort the problem out without us having to intervene for a third time.
They said, though, that it was part of their contract, and that's fair enough. And she signed it, and they sent a letter out. So how did you manage to get the money back for her?
Well, you know, our pensions reporter, Sandra Jeffries, just taken the mantle on this one and just run with it and managed to... I think that they are sort of realising that this is not a very fair practice, and it does not make them look very good, the fact that they're doing this. And, you know, it's a FTSE 100 company. Tanya's written about this a couple of times now. We've had no other reader get in touch from any other company that have had the same problem. So why stand out from the crowd for doing something rubbish when you can sort it out, obviously, quite easily once we get in touch? That's what I hate when we have to do this, when we have to step in and do this on behalf of our readers. Why can't companies just treat people fairly in the first place?
If this has happened to you at this company or indeed any other company...
Get in touch with tanya.jeffries@thisismoney.co.uk.
All right, then, let's turn on to something a little bit more positive. How would you like to win enough money to cover your energy bills for almost a decade? It sounds rather tempting, doesn't it? Especially when you consider the fact that we've just had a wave of price hikes thanks to the big six energy suppliers. Your average bill is now an eye-watering £1,155. Well, Simon, This Is Money and Mail Online readers can now join your latest... I should do this for a career. No obligation. Collective energy switch, and there's a 10 grand prize draw. But even if you don't get that, those who join the scheme in January actually knock £251 off their bill. So I'm going to have to ask, what is collective switching? And I know this is, dare I say, a gimmick, as it's yours, but it's, to a certain extent it is a gimmick, I'm sorry, but collective switching can be a good thing because it's basically using people power to say to the big companies, you know, sort out your pricing.
Yeah, power to the people, as Wolfie Smith would say.
Exactly.
So the idea is that you gang up on the energy companies. So instead of just fighting it as one man or woman alone trying to get the best deal, you get together with a load of other people who'd also like to save money on their energy bills, and the companies compete to offer you the best deal they possibly can. Now, why would they do that? Well, because it means that they get in a nice big chunk of extra customers, and energy companies not like to build their customer base. And one by one, obviously they maybe don't notice, but if they can get an extra 10,000 customers in one hit, then that's great news for them. And they can also offer a special deal. So they know that, that special deal will only go to those customers. It won't go to everyone. So for example, energy company slashes its rates, offers special deal, throws it open to everyone. They suddenly get a ton of people through the door. All of a sudden, they've got loads of people they're giving cheap energy to. Mm-hmm. Now, if you've got a chunk of people and they go, right, I'm willing to get that chunk of people in as a customer, and I'll offer them this deal. So you register, then at the end of the period, the energy companies will compete. They'll say, right, we're going to offer people this. And energy company B says, right, we're going to offer them that. Energy company C says, oh, no, but we're going to offer them this. And then it gets presented to you, and you can make the decision to take it, or you can make the decision to leave it and stay with your existing energy supplier. But if you do sign up for this, you also get the chance to win £10,000, which is about 10 years worth of your energy bills at current prices, although there is no stipulation that you have to spend it on your energy bills for the next 10 years.
The ratings are going up in 10 years. I wonder how much it will be then. I don't really want to think about it.
That's why I said at today's prices.
Exactly. One thing, not to rain on your parade here, but, you know, by calling it a gimmick, I sort of started that process. The idea
it's a gimmick.
Of collective switching is based on price as opposed to somewhere with good customer relations and that sort of thing. Are we solely basing things too much on price?
Well, Georgie, we're not going to do a collective switch and put people into an energy company that doesn't have a good customer
service. Point, yeah.
You know, it will be better. We're not just going to put you for Energy Sharks UK and leave you there, and then you're going to have awful customer service and it's all going to fall apart. It is done via our partner, and they, you know, will pick obviously it's done on price, but we're going to make sure that you're energy is, yep, and your customer service is going to be just as what it is if you hadn't switched it. I've said this before, you don't get a better quality by the gas and electric. You just get it in your house and it's there. It's not like,
yeah,
a guest but customer service.
But you can have terrible customer service, can't you?
Yeah. But you know, we'll be on hand. Our energy helpline, you know, partner will be there to answer questions. Yeah.
Note to self, make sure Energy Helpline doesn't offer deal from Energy Sharks UK.
Yeah, absolutely. But Lee, we're talking about energy prices going up. Why have they gone up so much? And we're hearing as well that they could go up again over winter shortages and the like.
Well, in the last couple of years, we've actually had it fairly good in terms of our energy prices. And it's been actually a little bit lower than what it was in previous years. But of course, at one point, there was going to be a sting in the tower, and that has been this year. A bit like in other industries, it almost is a bit cartel-like. You know, we call them the big six for a reason, because like one puts a price up and then they all tend to put a price up. British Gas, 12.5% last week, prices went up on average, you know, and they're saying, well, we didn't put prices up last year and, you know, they've tried to hold back as much as possible. And what they'll say is it's rising wholesale costs. That's what the reason is that they always say. But all I can say is that if your bill, if you're one of sort of British Gas customers, you know, hundreds of thousands of customers that have seen their prices go up, don't just sit around and just say, oh, I've been a British Gas customer for decades and I've never had a problem with them. Just get out there.
Are you listening, mother? Are you listening?
Get out there and have a look at, you know, how much money you can save. Get involved in this collective switch. I know you're saying it's a tiny bit gimmicky, but in the same way, it is kind of cool to be like a big group of people trying to drive down the best deal. I actually think I quite like it. I think it's quite a cuddly, fun process.
All right, finally, Lee. So glad you're back here, because Lee, you couldn't make last week's podcast. You were too busy camped outside the Bank of England, weren't you, Lee? Trying to get your hands on one of the first polymer tenors. I got my first two today. Graciously, Simon suggested, though, that your fearless reporting, it was all in the name of personal finance journalism. I, on the other hand, had my doubts, Lee. Remember the fuss over the new £5 notes, the one with the low serial numbers going on eBay for a load of money? Lee, I think that's really why you went down there, that if you got yourself a really low number, that was it, you're going on holiday. Don't worry, Simon, I'm doing it for the sake of personal finance journalism. Anyway, over the weekend, though, This Is Money received a number of emails from readers who say they got their hands on ones with an AA01 serial number, and they want to know if it was worth, well, more than a tenner.
So let me paint a picture here for you, Georgie. Last week, I didn't camp outside the Bank of England.
Although, every poor story improves
in the
telling.
There were people there with camping chairs and all sorts queuing for 9 o'clock. The counter opened at 9 o'clock at the Bank of England for people to swap notes. So
when were you there, Lee?
I'll paint the scene.
Okay,
I'll set the scene
for
you. I left the house at just gone 5 a.m. I could see the stars twinkling in the sky. I could hear the toot of a faraway owl, the zephyrs of wind going across me as I went to the train station and got on a really sleepy early morning train, which was really busy. What was everyone doing?
Yeah,
they've got really early morning jobs. Anyway, I got to the Bank of England at about 6:30. I thought, well, if I'm going to do it, let's do it right. Let's just get down there, get the note, see what it's all about, see what the fuss is all about. I did not expect to see a queue outside the Bank of England of the public wanting to switch notes. But of course, what's happened, and as you quite rightly point out, last year, with the new £5 note, the new Churchill Parliament note, there was a big rush of excitement for them. And people did start putting those notes onto eBay, and they were selling for, you know, relatively tidy sums. I'm not going to start quoting figures that perhaps some other rival publications might have said, but they were selling for tidy sums. Now, if you do get an early serial numbered note, as some readers have said they have over the weekend, they can be worth a fair amount of money. I'm not going to start saying they're worth thousands, but you know, one note you're probably going to be looking at 6-7 times its value. And if you've got three notes in a row, I mean, we saw an example the other day, 250 quid, three notes, AA01 notes, consecutive serial numbers, you know, sold for 250 quid. That's £220 profit. That's not bad, is it, on three £10 notes? Now, I know you're rolling your eyes at that and you're going, oh my God, what are people up to? But some people do collect these, do collect notes and coins, and they want early examples. And AA01 is a, you know, first off the presses. And it's like you've got that then in your collection. And if you wait too long, these notes start getting crumpled up and they're not in mint condition anymore. And just to add to your excitement, Georgie, there's a charity auction at the start of October. And there was one last year, Bank of England, I reported on. I know, I was sad enough to stay in the office at night to watch the auction live. And the first note, which was AA000017, sold for £4,150 for one note. So AA01, number one, goes to the Queen. And a couple of other lower number ones go to people close to the process. This time round, this auction next month, there's a AA01000010, which is a good number because it's a £10 note and the serial number's number 10. It's got an estimate of £2,000 to £3,000. I spoke to Jesse McClure, my friend, my American TV presenter friend, who's also
Groundhog Day.
He is an auction expert. Yeah. He reckons that note's going to go for around about £10,000 next month, and I'll be going. I'll be there. I'm not going to be bidding, but I'm going to be watching.
I blame you, Lee, though, for all this. Lee. There are people, not in a bad way. And the reason, because I tweeted you when I went out for dinner once, and everybody started looking at their £5 notes, and I just let's just pay. Can we please pay? And it just took ages because everyone was checking to see if. But because of your wondrous reporting on these issues, it means that general people that were safe, and there are people that like to save these, you know, numbers and get that. Yeah, it means everybody is now wanting to do it.
I know. I do feel partly.
You've single-handedly.
Pumped up the coins and notes and whatnot. But no, hold on, let me rewind to last year, Georgie, when I was just the first to spot that those £5 notes were selling. They were selling on eBay. It wasn't that they were just being bid up and, you know, going up. They were being sold for massive sums. And I noticed that. And of course, I'm going to write a story about that. And of course, then what happens is everyone wants to know if they've got a low serial number note. And everyone's checking their note because they don't want to give away a fortune. And that's why these stories have been so popular, because there's nothing worse than thinking that you've given away something that might be valuable to someone else. You know, it's a horrible feeling, isn't it? So, of course, everyone checks the serial number on their banknotes now. It's absolutely ridiculous. And to the public, I apologise.
No, not at all. And I have to say, Lee, the original and the best when it comes to coin and note reporting.
Oh, Georgie, honestly, I didn't know that my journalistic career was going to boil down to being the best.
But the
at
public
coins
love
and notes.
It. We love it, don't we? We're reading all these stories, right?
Best piece of advice in Lee's story this week came from the aforementioned Jesse McClure, who said, if you get your hands on one of these AAA01 notes, one of the really low numbered ones, sell it now. Sell it soon. He said, sell it while the mania is still on, because once it subsides, they won't be worth as much money. So, I mean, obviously, if you do get your hands on that one at the Bank of England auction, then you could probably hold on to that for years. But if you just get hold of any random low serial numbered one and you think it might be worth something, get out there, get on eBay, do it now while the mania is still going. Otherwise, it'll go the way of tulips and they just won't be worth what they once were.
Until the £20 comes out.
I've got three years to relax and sort that, Georgie.
Oh, my goodness. Editor Simon Lambert, Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you enjoy our humble podcast, don't forget to share the love and rate us on iTunes.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.